Oh, dude. Your accents just get worse and worse as they go on. You're making me kind of laugh. But at the same time, I'm kind of going, no, stop now. No, stop now. Come on. Stop now. Anyway, this has been Undies Funded Records and Radio saying, ha ha ha. Stop now.
You're listening to Man Behind a Machine on Inspirato Projector Radio.
I want to get you on record talking about this because I don't think I've heard about this movie. All right, let's see. So Cat People. What is the premise of Cat People?
The premise of the original Cat People was that there was a woman whose family was cursed, and she would turn into a panther at night. And there were other members of her family who did it as well, I believe. And she fell in love with a man, but he couldn't love her because she was a cat. And I can't remember how it ended, but it was an RKO picture, and it was produced by Val Lewton or Lawton. He made about 5 or 6 films in a row that are just fantastic in the 40s. I Walked with a Zombie.
Cat People came out way back then.
Yeah, 1942.
Okay. Was it like a full moon kind of thing, or was it? What was the circumstance that made him a cat?
It was just in her family. It was in her blood. There was one called The Leopard Man, which was similar, except it had a man as the main character who turned into a cat. But in my generation, the only reason I saw the original was because I really liked the 1982 version of Cat People, with Malcolm McDowell, William Hurt, and Nastasia Kinski, which was written by Paul Schrader. And people complain about the film now. They think it's kind of the consensus that it's a terrible film, but as a child, it made a great impression on me.
Why do they think it's terrible?
Because...
Is it the writing, the special effects, the acting?
Flies off the rails. It starts being very focused, and it ends up as one of those really unfocused stories. Paul Schrader... As a child, I believe his parents were, God, I'm going to give you all wrong information. They were Methodist. They were some sect that was fairly strict. Mm. And Paul Schrader wanted to rebel when he was a child. He wasn't allowed to watch films. So when he watched a film like Cat People, his brain went into this fevered over-imagination.
Oh.
He wrote Taxi Driver.
Oh, wow. He made the remake of Cat People?
He directed wrote it, yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's really, psychosexual is the word for it. It's very, very sexualized. Whereas the original film, I think, got to that point with a lot of poetry. So the original is a much better film.
More what's that word that I'm thinking of? Not nuances, but like innuendos? Like that
yes,
kind of
it's
thing
very subtle, which they had to be. Both because of the Hays Code and because of special effects, certainly. The remake of Cat People has a scene where a character's arm is ripped off, and it's quite graphic, so they could do things that they couldn't do back then. But it doesn't necessarily make the film better. Sometimes it does, but not always.
I like those films where they allude to things. To me, it's more exciting to kind of imagine what might have happened between these two characters than seeing it. And don't get me wrong, it's great to see movies where, you know, there's a lot of TNA jumping around getting murdered by, you know, Jason or what have you. But it's also cool. It's also like really, I like seeing like a Jimmy Stewart film and you're like, there's something going on. You could tell that either they just finished doing something or they're about to go do something, but the way that they're talking about what may or may not happen, there's something, I like that. There's something really cool about that idea.
Yeah, definitely. Subtext in anything, theater, film, writing. Now that I'm writing books, one thing that people argue about is how much to describe. How much should the character describe? How much should we give the audience? And the correct answer more and more is becoming as little as possible. One or two lines that are very evocative, and then the audience is going to have a better imagination. If you've really got a grasp on this character and what the character wants, then the audience will fill in the details for themselves of exactly what it looks like. And if you give one well-timed detail, you can really kind of have an influence on how they see the character. But these guys who are writing, you know, 2 pages of, you know, dialogue, we call it an APB report, where he was just, he was 5'6", had, you know, shoulder length hair, eyebrows.
That is such a tricky thing, too, because, like, there's that, on the one hand, you're thinking, like, I want to bring these people into this moment and have them really see the details of, like, what's going on and the textures and... And then there's that, you know, showing without telling. So there's that like, I'm battling. So what do you ought to say about that? Well, first, Jamie Lee, what do you have to say about that? And then I want to hear your dream about the cast.
Ask me the question. I was looking something up.
Oh, geez. Oh, no. Well, the showing without telling
showing
aspect.
Showing without telling.
Yeah. Like in stuff. We're talking about, for instance, in some books, some people really spell out exactly what you see. He was just saying that now there's this idea of showing or talking as little about what's going on as possible. And then I said, well, gosh, you know, but then also we also want everybody to be there in that moment, feeling those textures, seeing those things, you know. And then, but then on top of that, there's that showing without telling aspect. So
sure. I caught the tail end of Scott's response. I think that whatever makes sense for the context of what you're trying to do in any given moment is the first rule. Sometimes if you're trying to... show instead of tell, you end up going a very long way when you might have just told. And if you can tell it very simply and quickly, which goes along with Scott's, as a couple of lines of dialogue and show it, you know, or give them the subtext that then shows them what's really going on, that's great. Sometimes you can't. I don't think it should be a diehard rule. I've spent a lot of time trying to show and not tell, only to later... just go back and tell. And I've also had the experience of showing and not telling, and it puts too much weight on one section of the story instead of where I really want people focused, and then sometimes everything looks balanced. But as often as you can, you should give the audience a seed that is that grows into the image in their head. I think you want to, one of the things I know you want to do is you want to at least be encouraging them to create pictures in their mind. About every 4 or 5 words, you want something they can create an image off of, because we know that the human mind, when it's reading, creates images about every 4 or 5 words. So if you can push it, you know, 6 and 8, but the longer you go on without giving them something they can see, or even if it's in their own mind, without engendering that in them, the quicker they lose focus, the quicker they lose their interest in continuing on.
So do you think within those 4 or 5 words for them to sort of establish this context or this idea, would it be better to put bigger word, like a word that covers a lot of bases, or one word that just covers one base? In other words,
whatever word, it depends how, it depends on what spell is needed to create the magic effect that you're going after.
Yeah,
you know, if it's 10 words and 10 words, if it's 2 words, then 2. You also have to have a grasp on, you know, and it becomes tricky because you know the image in your head. But knowing what will engender a image that does the job, it won't be the same image. It can't be the same image. They're not psychic. But a word that creates a picture that does the job, that pushes your audience to where you want them to be, whether that's from who's driving the character's point of view driving the scene, or whether it's just the way you want them to feel at any given moment, whether you're trying to lull them so you can then freak them out, or whether you're freaking them out so you can then heal their wounds. Whatever that is, fewer words, I think, are better if you can paint that picture better. Now, that said, there's all sorts of senses, and a lot of people sub-vocalize in their head. They just read and they hear. The more you read, the less you do that. Most people. Some people, that never goes away. So it has to also sound good. So if you can imagine that it's being, even if it's a medium that's not meant to be read out loud, it is being read out loud by a lot of people inside. So it's not exactly out loud, but they're hearing it as if it is in their mind. So you just pay attention to that. And the whole reason we see an image every 4 or 5 words has more to do with the way with eye fatigue. Mm. And you should say that some of the stuff they've done on this with linguistics and the study of imagery, and I forget what you call it when you combine the study of language with the study of imagery, but it's something. It might even be symbolism, but it's not quite symbolism. It's something along those lines. You find out it's about the audience is going to get tired all the time. So it's constantly your job to wake them up.
Oh. And you have to consider pace as well. A lot of what you were talking about is simply about pace. The portions of the story that you want to go faster, you're not going to spend a lot of attention on detail.
Oh, yeah.
So I think most writers, at least as far as novel writing is concerned, or literature is concerned, everyone has the sections, you know, at the beginning of a chapter where they stop and describe things. But even those, I think, can be pared down. I think the more specific small details, how somebody sits down or how somebody eats, can fill in a lot of the blanks in the reader's minds. So the few details that you get should not necessarily be visual details. Or if it is, maybe just a piece about the clothing that they wear.
You don't want to get too specific.
Yes.
It's going to contradict what they've already seen a lot of times. Mm.
It takes
you into a mental corner in their head.
Yes. In my first book, the main character, the way I describe him, I think the only thing I describe him is that he's wearing a wide-notch lapel suit and the lapels almost cover his shoulders. And I thought from that the audience would get,
that's
you know,
right.
Short
they can fill
and
in
squat.
All the colors,
yeah.
All the details, the textures, you know, the pattern,
yeah.
So to speak.
And that would be enough to describe him, especially compared to who he was standing next to.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's just little details like that. And you see that in actors who put on just one small piece and that
sure.
makes the character. I knew an actress who, she wore a mole
mm-hmm.
and it was a fake mole and she well, of course she wore it, but she would, it was too small to be seen by the audience members. It was just for her.
Mm-hmm.
Once that mole was on, she was that character.
Mm.
It was like a trigger
right.
for her. And, you know, that's just one little small detail, but for her, it filled in just years and years of character history and gaps and motivations and everything like that. So I think those small details, the more specific they are and the smaller they are, will lead to big worlds of characters.
You know, and I can't think of, like perfect examples from either of these two novels, but I can tell you two novels that do it perfectly. The few words, giant images. The Great Gatsby by Fitzgerald is one of them. The other one is Bright Lights, Big City by Jay McInerney, who was compared to Fitzgerald when he brought that book out. And that book, out of the two, is probably the best that I've ever read with saying painting a mural instead of a picture with a couple of words sometimes. And I remember being wowed again and again. But what's strange about that novel for a lot of people is it's also – it's written in the second person.
Oh.
Which is an art form or a way of writing, a point of view that I wish that people would write more of.
Well, that's the one any writing professor will always introduce it last. They'll introduce first person, then the third person omniscient. They'll introduce everything, and then the last one, and this thing exists. And they'll like write second person.
Yeah. I mean, God bless them for being teachers, and you know, and for like having classes that people who want to be writers can take. Otherwise, what do you have? You have math and science, which is important if you're a writer too. But for the most part, anytime you have a teacher who is telling you don't, you shouldn't take that as gospel. There's just less and less rules all the time. And if anywhere I've tripped up, it's been out of fear. Because I heard in screenwriting class A or I read in book B, don't do this. And then, you know, you get a little older and you go out in the world and you go to see a movie or you pick up a book and someone's done it and it's a big hit. And you realize that professor, as well-meaning as they were, was wrong.
Yeah.
So be careful about
carving their own
learn what you can, but try not to learn anything you shouldn't do. There's no reason to just do it.
Well,
but if you want to do it, you should try it.
Well, one thing, they have to tell students that. On the other hand, they have to tell them that because it's impossible to explain exactly. You have to know the rules before you can break them, which is a universal truth in anything in life, I found. But that's not very exciting to a new student. So I think presenting it as a, no, don't do this, mm-hmm. like right off the bat, eventually the theory is they will learn why they shouldn't do that and then how they can.
I think that's true for any student that, unless it's a student who is only able to do it that way. Let's say you have a student who is great at writing second person, but they suck at writing first person. And they suck at writing third person. But they really want to write. Well, I think eventually if they keep writing second person and they write it enough, they're going to learn enough about writing that when they go and they tackle first person or third person. I was certainly that way with math. I didn't pick up math in school. I wasn't interested in math. It looked like a language from Mars, not actually from Mars as far as I know, but math. And later, many, 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 many years later, when I needed math, I learned the parts of math that would allow me to do construction valuations of all things. And by learning those parts, I then had to like sort of piece math together for myself, and now I can do math. You know, I don't think I would have ever learned it in the traditional system, even if I had been in school 1,000 years. I wasn't going to. I was a non-math student, but going and learning it my way allowed me to pick up those pieces. But that's not everybody all the time, and I think when you're talking about university, or you're talking about a school of any size, really, you do have to look at what's good for the group as well as the individual. But that kind of it gets messy.
I'm imagining how a lot of these teachers, they're there giving all this information. They're reading from books. They're giving this outdated information. They have no choice but to give outdated information because they're not actually actively out there doing anything. So they're giving all of this information to these students. They're programming their brains with all this stuff. And now the students are they're so fearful when they get out of that institution, and they're scared to maybe experiment because they don't know that it's okay to experiment, you know. So they're just stuck in this particular set and this mindset. Coming from someone who's teaching them, who hasn't done any of that stuff in who knows how long, that's why it was so kick-ass about Columbia College, which I love so much, was that sometimes Brian Shaw wasn't there to teach an acting class because he was off for rehearsals for his play. Or he was busy, at a commercial shoot. You know, it's like, yeah, dude, they're out there doing this stuff. And then they come back and then they would report these stories to us. And we go, oh, what's it like out there, you know? And so they're like willing to be like these scouts, you know, and scouting out the real world. And they come back with, it was great, with this information. And they're like, whoa, okay, that's what it's like out there. So it was cool to be able to have this mental idea as to how to connect it. You know, because, man, you know, how cool would that be if there were a lot of these classes that go, okay, we're teaching this information. Here's how to connect it. here's some avenues that you can connect it into. And when you, unless you have something that's like that, you know, where you feel like they got your back the whole time rather than just go, fly, you know.
Sure, sure. You know, I think that also depends on what they're doing on the outside. I think it's absolutely a plus that at Columbia College in Chicago, they had teachers working in the field that they were teaching. But at the same time, if the work that they're doing in that field is the same work over and over again, over a long enough length of time, it turns into the same kind of self-fulfilling prophecy of the English teacher saying, never do the second person, you know, or only do the second person after you've mastered everything else. Because you can actively be in a rut as much as you sitting in a classroom teaching from the same book all of the time. If your experience is outside are always the same. You come into the classroom and teach them as the only way you're going to run into trouble.
Yeah.
For the most part, I didn't see that with most of the teachers that I had at Columbia.
Yeah, they're out there exploring. They're getting this information. They're showing us how they're applying it. They're doing great things, and then showing us, look, this is you can do this exact same thing too. And then a lot of times they think of us when they were out there at Steppenwolf or some other place like that. They go, oh, what about this guy? You know, he was in my play, and you know, he's really good. I can imagine him playing this character. So that was really cool too, because they were trying to plug us into this this stuff at the Steppenwolf Theater. Sheldon set up this audition. It was the American premiere of this UK play called Mojo, and it was about this guy named Johnny Silver, and Johnny Silver is like this young sort of punk, like punk rock kind of pop kind of kid. But it's like through the whole play, you only see him two times. And he has one little line at the very end, but he's like everybody's talking about him the whole time on stage. His managers, his agents, everybody who has a piece of him, so to speak, is out here talking about it. You know, the roadies, the freaking other bandmates, and you're like, oh my God, this is so interesting. And just to think that Sheldon would think of me as possibly to be this Silver Johnny dude,
sure,
was just such a kick-ass thing, you know? Just to know that, wow, I can trust this person's word, because they're not just, you know, talk about some outdated thing. Now, what if you started right out of the gate? What if they teach you right out of the gate to start writing from the second person?
Well,
right? Wouldn't that be so kick-ass? Master that first. How cool would that be?
Yeah, I mean, that would be cool in the sense that it's not done, and it might inspire you to write in another person.
Yeah.
But I mean, if they then said, don't ever write in the first person positive, I think then the first person positive becomes the pariah. That there's no reason to say that the first person is just as, you know, none of them should be thrown out. I think the only real rule, and really the only piece of advice that I would give anyone, is it's about whatever you can get away with. And you don't know if you can get away with it until you try it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It depends also what you're trying to do.
Well, and following a vision.
Well, you're always following a vision. But sometimes you have sometimes you're concerned about the audience. Sometimes you don't give a shit about the audience.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends on what you're doing and what the context is. If you're writing for a particular medium or a particular form and a particular audience, and you're going to need to take them all into consideration. If, for example, you wouldn't want to show a silent movie to the blind. Right, mm-hmm. But there are people that would do that, and then they would say, "Well, you know, I'm following my vision."
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, like a social experiment. If that's okay with you, that's okay. It's probably not okay with the blind that you invited, who paid money, if they paid money or paid time. But if it's if you're learning, if you're experimenting, if you're trying to find your voice. If you're trying to weed out the bullshit in the books, and I think they should burn most of the... Not burn, because we don't burn books, because that has bad associations to, you know, bad people. But we should then burn all of the writers of the screenwriting books at the stake. I don't really feel like we should, but sometimes I do. I think they overly complicate the issue. I think... What we should do is we should take anybody who wants to write scripts, for example, and just put them in a room with a bunch of scripts. And we don't even need a room. We have the internet now. And just say, read 100 of these and, you know, tear these apart. And then go take an improv class and a science class and go live a little. But trying to learn how to do art from a set of rules can be damaging, but it can be helpful if you're unable to put borders around your own work. Because you can't, I mean, you should always have something that constrains you, or it's going to be stream of consciousness forever. And that's great for you, but we've all got a stream of consciousness. We have to keep up with our own. Nobody can come and watch yours all the time. So if you have your own personal algorithm that says, I'm going to drive this close to this edge and that close to that edge, and I'm going to work within these borders, amazing things can happen. You can break all sorts of rules within a context. You can break all the rules without a context, but no one's going to give a fuck. If you don't care, that's fine.
How do you prefer to make your art?
I've got it. Just depends on what I'm working on.
What kind of borders are you setting, and what right are you giving that the author of those borders? Like, what makes those the borders that are the necessary ones?
Well, I'm working in a form that has a very limited amount of time. I'm writing television scripts. We're talking about, if we're talking about a drama, I've got 60 pages to tell my story. That's a big border. You know, when you write, when I was a playwright, I could write really, really long plays if I wanted to, or as short as I wanted to, and you could still find a venue. The by restricting my story to 60 pages, it forces me to tell my story in a more succinct, more precise, simpler, no matter how complicated it is.
And it is a fun challenge, right, to try to find what are those root golden nuggets of those ideas that I want to bring
across. Otherwise you're always relying on inspiration. And if you're only relying on inspiration and not craft, even if it's your own craft, your own type of craft, then you're gonna have long periods of time where no matter how excited you were at the beginning, eventually you're going to become so invested in a piece and into your third draft, and you're just going to become, I wouldn't say bored with the story, but you're going to want to move on to something else. But if what you're trying to do is something you can measure, you know, if you're saying, I can't tell my whole story and still have that really long scene that's really awesome, then you have to go back and find another way to do what the work that that scene is doing in a different way. And the more you do that, it's like working out, right? You got to tear.
What if you're the boss?
I am the boss.
Well, okay. So you're working within a certain format.
You know, even if I'm getting paid, I'm still the boss. I can still say "fuck you" and I can walk away. I'm always the boss.
Right.
It might not be great for my career to do that, but I'm always the boss.
People are, well, knowing that possibility exists is just great. Just to know that your future self is someone is giving you monetary as well as all other kinds of other kinds of value systems, like towards just creating what you want to create, how you want to create it, with the people you want to create it with. I mean, can you imagine like the kind of crazy brainstorming sessions that just the three of us would have with? If we are given, like, funding to create, let's say if someone only gave us, like, I don't know, $20,000 to make something, right? I'm sure we could come up with an idea for a fairy cake and create that thing.
Anyone listening?
Yeah.
$20,000.
That's right.
We'll take that.
That's right. We will take that, and we will make a lot of cool stuff with it. Now imagine, okay, so now episodes are chopped up into either longer and then like short, so like let's say you only get 6 episodes and they're like 2 hours each or whatever, or maybe they're half an hour and there's only 10 episodes. Well, for instance, with Twin Peaks The Return, there was 18 hour-long episodes.
Yeah.
So the olden days it was like 24 or something, right?
Well, yeah, but you were trying to, then each story was much more self-contained than is the current trend. So you had 24 separate stories about the same characters, usually within a very strict genre. You had 24 police procedurals. Boom. You know, they were going to have 24 stories in a season. And maybe if you were lucky, there'd be a little bit of character change or a little arc there, but probably not.
So how cool would that be is to dial it back to that the days of reminiscence of 24 episodes, but you do half an hour. So they're like, oh, a bite-sized piece, you know, almost leave it on a cliffhanger each time. And that would afford for so many even more characters. And
well, 42 minutes. I mean, that's, if you have a drama with commercials right there, now we're down to 42. You've lost, what, 18 minutes.
Mm.
See, math, I had to think about that for a second. So, and that's close to what you're talking about. And in a comedy, 22 minutes. A story can be told in whatever, you know, whatever box you have to tell your story, and you can tell a version of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just telling it the best version of that story in that box. And some boxes are better for other stories, for some stories than others, I should say. Theater was different, though, in a little bit. Theater... You have a group of people, you have an ensemble. So then it becomes about, I'm thinking about this from a directing standpoint. It becomes about creating an atmosphere not a safe atmosphere in the sense that we talk about it now, but an atmosphere where everyone is safe to be imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, yes. And no matter what that means, and to forgive each other their sins.
Mm, yeah.
And to know that the fact that they're human and fallible won't be something they're judged on, as long as they're, you know, all working together in the pursuit of something singular, which is the final, I don't want to say the final product, because you go on and you do many shows, and every show is different because it's live theater, but the play. It's all about the play, and if it's all about the play, when we're in the early parts of rehearsal and we can experiment, we can... And what we're doing there is that we're experimenting with finding out how to work together. And you do the same thing when you write. When you get an idea, you don't just sit down. Usually, sometimes it's happened, but it's very rare, where you just sit down and you nail it on the first try. You know? Choreography, that was... It kind of ruined me for a long time because I wrote it in 3 days. And it was pretty much the first draft, and it worked. So then for years after, when plays would take months or a play would take a year, I was like, what have I forgotten? I really hadn't forgotten anything. It was just the right moment for that play to come out that way. But when you sit down and you've got your ideas, you're creating a place that's safe for your ideas to flow through you. And Brad was talking about procrastination and routines and the funny things they do before they sit down. But all of that is part of that process too. The audience just doesn't get to see that. And you don't have other actors, or you don't have actors, and you don't have other people when you're in that situation at home alone working to participate. But you have to go through that same process all by yourself. It's much easier when there's people supporting you. It's much harder when there are people who are doing are present but doing the opposite. The best thing about working with other people is they're always going to bring a lot more than you could, no matter how smart you might be. Even if you're a genius, okay, they're always going to bring something that you couldn't, because it's theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an advantage, and you should be open to advantages. I would have had the worst sets in set history. The worst lights in light history if I'd been left at that time, because I didn't know anything about art direction at that time or lights at that time. And I was just like, it's fine, it'll be cool, because I was focused on one thing. So, but I did know enough to trust my lighting guy and my set designer. And man, they made me always look better than I was. And that's kind of what artists can do for each other, is they can make what they bring individually greater.
Oh my God, I'm just getting so filled with inspiration. I've been thinking so much lately about writing a play, getting a play together out here, you know? And oh my God, I'm thinking maybe it would be awesome for us to brainstorm on a fun play that we could put out here.
Sure.
There's that space out here, Sun Space. We could put it up there for free. It's like 50 seats.
Really?
Plus...
For
we could utilize
for free.
And we could utilize a projection screen too.
Yeah.
So that would be cool too, because you know, while people are walking through the forest or whatever,
you know.
You got the it's up there behind them, you know? Oh God, that could be so fun.
Oh, for sure.
The sets to be a projection? I mean, dude, that's awesome. And you add set pieces too, very simple, but it all becomes oh man, that could be so much fun.
And having access to something like that, there's no reason that a theater like the one you just talked about shouldn't have a line of people waiting to do shows. And I think I know
right now
where
it's mostly rock shows right now.
Yeah.
I haven't been up there yet, but it's in a place called Shadow Hills, and that's where I'm having the Bloody Bobby.
I mean, if you have a space, use it. Use whatever you have, and start now. Don't wait until everything is perfect or you have enough money, because even if you had enough money, if it's your first time out, you're liable to make mistakes, and you probably don't want them to be big expensive mistakes. If that has 500 people watching while you make an ass of yourself, now you might turn out to be, you know, you might come out, you know, a genius with amniotic fluid still on you, but that usually doesn't happen. So it's, you should start wherever you are immediately so you can improve. So by the time opportunities to present your work to larger audiences or to work with people you've always wanted to work with or in a medium that was unavailable to you either geographically or because you you just hadn't worked your way into a position for that opportunity, come along. You want to be, you want to be ready, and you want to, you sort of want to be a little bit humble, I think. I think you, before, you know, you don't want to try climbing the largest mountain you can find until you've failed to climb a few small ones, you know? Because you're going to learn why you failed, and you can fail at 2,000 feet and live.
Yeah.
But at 20,000 feet, you may not make it down to the bottom of the mountain.
Oh, that's a good way of putting it.
There's a lot of people who, right out of the gate, were given everything they needed for whatever reason, and you never hear from them again. And it isn't just because people won't work with them again. I mean, sometimes they will, but the experience was just so terrible that, that whatever kernel was inside of them, that, that little ember, it, instead of flaring and starting this giant fire like everyone wanted it to.
Right, right.
Gets doused with 300 fire hoses as opposed to a cup of water, which would have happened if they tried first on a smaller scale and could have learned. And then eventually they would have been this great fire starter, maybe. And they, if that happened to you, you should get up off the stool or the chair or the couch or pull the car over and just start right now. And start again, because that there's no way that ember went totally out. It's just probably buried under a bunch of self-deprecating crap. I'm covered in it often, and I shovel my way back out. But you have to shovel your way out. No one's perfect. Don't expect to be.
What are some tools? What do you guys utilize? What do you think are important for you in reinvigorating that fire going? Do you think it's having cooperative people around you who are very yes and minded, who are willing to like just like okay, let's just keep unpacking it. Do you think it's important to listen to a certain kind of music? Like, what are some of the things that help you with that? Here, maybe if you can answer that. In the meantime, I'm gonna get you coffee.
For me, I think the biggest thing isn't necessarily anything I do. Reading is what reignites me, because if I I read the same books that I read that got me interested in the first place, because it reminds me of what I want to do. And I know a lot of artists with their career goals, sometimes they get more focused on what's right in front of them. But the career goal, I think, always pushes you to reignite the flames. There are certain things that I want. I want a bookshelf with all of my books on it. Mm-hmm. And I want there to be a lot of books. So that would be one goal for me that would push me forward.
Hey, Jen.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
How you doing?
Good, it's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Hi, I'm Jenny. Scott.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
So these guys, we had them on, they were on K-Chung today. And so we went out for an adventure. And we just got back, and I was like, man, we gotta brainstorm. So guess what, Jen? You're on the podcast here.
Thank you.
Look who you're getting.
I think, and to answer your question, like you said, music, for example. I mean, yeah, for sure. Scott and I were talking the other night about this, about how even if I think I know how I want an episode to play out from beginning to end, and I can see it in my head, and even if I have a first draft on the page or I just have it outlined, I'll go outside, I'll put on some headphones, and I'll play the episode from beginning to end, and I'll listen to different genres of music. And two things about that. One, you have to be careful. You can't assume, because you're seeing it in your head, to that music that it feels that way. But two, if you like how that feels, then you can sometimes go in and let that music sort of excite you to change a thing back towards something you find exciting. Because you can get stale on yourself, even if the work isn't stale. And it's very, 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 very hard to know, for me, what where the boring parts are. Because eventually I'm going to be bored with anything that I've read 30 times. You know, if I've read the same scene 30 times, there's probably A, nothing wrong with it, or B, it should be thrown out one or the other, but not necessarily. But listening to music will then push me along. What else keeps me going? A lot of coffee keeps me going. Exercise should be keeping me going more than it is, but, at times it has been all that's kept me going. Watching other people's work, reading, like especially reading, again, Scott, when he said reading was right on, and back to locking, you know, new writers into a room with a bunch of books or a bunch of, but only books, you know, if they're going to be fictionalized, only fiction books, no books and writing books. And then let them read those later if they want to. I think Scott might disagree with that a little bit.
No.
And maybe I am being too severe.
No, but one thing I wanted to add, if we talk about this work kind of process, we were also discussing the other night, I was telling him how if I have an entire day to write, for example, the first 2 hours are extremely productive. And I'm writing. And then something happens after the two-hour break where anything I write will be generic. There will be nothing of value. I can write kind of placeholders, like during the scene this thing happens, and that's fine. But I can't really write a book the same way that I did for those 2 hours. I think for some people, there's a period where it's effective. And then that period is gone, and if you want to work on it, then you have to do kind of superficial things. I'll name chapters. Mm-hmm. I'll do some research on, you know, editing software that's out there that I can get. But eventually, I don't end up getting all that much done. So for some people, you know, they have to get really smart about how they do it. You know, they're working a job, but they have this thing they want to do, but then they kind of defeat themselves because they think they can't do it. They can't find the time to do it. And really, I think maybe you should check for yourself, but for me, I'm only effective a short period. So as long as I have that short period, I should be fine to work.
Conversely, I do my best work when I have a lot of time and a lot of momentum. And I'll work 12, 14 hours a day when I have the opportunity. I will take a lot of breaks. I will go outside if I can pull, unless it's really going well, in which case I do not want to get up, you know, at all. I don't even want to get up to use the restroom. I do. I don't have a jug by the desk that I'm urinating in because the story is going that well. But there is one of those dilemmas. What if, you know? What if you knew that if you got up, you would lose your thread? But the breaks are important. Because they keep you from numbing out. And your eyes get tired eventually. It's very physically challenging. People think, oh, you sit around in a chair all day. Go ahead and try it, pal. You know? That's what I say. You know, everyone's a writer. You know, fuck you, everyone's a writer. You know, that's not true. Everyone is a writer is a meaningless phrase. Writer is a phrase that is meaning that you bring to it. If your qualifications for being a writer are being met, then you're a writer. Now, are you a writer on a TV show where you're getting paid for every episode? And that's your only definition of what it means to be a writer? Then you're only a writer if that's your definition of it. But I wasn't always writing. I was writing. I originally wanted in the first grade. Because I went to a very small school, so everybody was one thing, and I wanted to be the kid that drew. I wanted to be the artist, you know, the painter or the illustrator. Though I don't think I knew the word illustrator in the first grade, but Jason Giles was better than I was at that, and Mrs. Engelman noticed that I wrote a pretty good short story for the first grade, and gave me positive encouragement. And I realized that I then could not stop. So you ask yourself, is it all about some long approval-seeking thing? Well, who knows what it's all about down below, but I do know that I always feel like it's exactly what I'm supposed to be doing, and that it's I crave it if I go a day without doing it, because there are
like they're just events that just get in the way, and there got to be a lot of serious events to make that happen. And I think that pretty much covers it. Whatever it was.
Right. Did you, was there something else you wanted to say concerning process or if you're stuck in a rut or things you might do to help kind of jumpstart, kickstart it back in shape?
Well, just to add something to what he said, I think the definition of if you're a writer or not that I heard that I really like is if you call yourself one. If somebody asks what do you do and you say I'm a writer, then you're a writer. And it's amazing how many people write but wouldn't call themselves a writer because they have this idea of what a writer should be.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, I think that's wrong. So now when people ask me what I do, I tell them I'm a writer.
Yeah.
I tell them I'm a novelist. Yeah. It's still not where I would hear that coming from my mouth and say, yeah, that's right. I would have to get a little more success. So my personal reason of why I would call myself a writer, I don't think I'm there yet. But, you know, if you say it, then that's what it is. It's true.
And I think there is a difference between...
faith.
Well, yeah, there's faith, yeah. But there's a difference between when you hear someone say, oh, yeah, I've got an idea for a screenplay, or I'm writing a screenplay, or... And saying, I'm a writer. Because a lot of people that will say, I'm writing a screenplay, are not going to say, I'm a writer. And... people who hear that, for example, there's this idea in town that everyone is a writer because everyone has a screenplay idea.
Oh.
Well, you know, a lot of those people that have a screenplay idea or even working on it occasionally over the weekend don't call themselves writers. They don't consider themselves writers. Mm. Some of them most likely should. I'm sure there's – in fact, you know, you'll come across – when I was working at the agency, you'll come across like – unsolicited submissions that you really can't accept, but because you don't know them and there's no non-disclosure agreement that's been signed, but you'll run into that same person on the outside, and this happens all the time.
Whoa.
And you get to talking and you won't tell them that
saw their script interesting come in and that
no one was able to read it, but if it comes up and they say, hey, I wrote this thing, would you look at it, and you read it, a lot of times you're like, Jesus Christ, someone should have read this script. And it's a question with no answer. It's like you can't mix a writer up in your mixing bowl. You can't go get the ingredients, so who the hell knows?
Yeah.
There's no right answer.
Right.
Just your personal one.
Write your own answer.
Absolutely. You know, write your own life.
So you are the writer.
Well, you have to be the star of your own story at all times.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's hard to do, and you're not always in your mind. But the fact of the matter is you are the star of your own story at all
times.
That's
really a great thing to know.
And the more you can remember that, for me anyway, the happier I am. That doesn't mean that I am the star of everyone else's story, you know, or at your expense. I mean, if we're competing... yes, at your expense, if possible. But, you know, and vice versa. You should be trying to cut my throat as well, if we're competing. But it's all...
vice versa.
As long as there's a reason for the competition. You know, I don't know if you've ever run into this situation where people are competing with you, but there's nothing to compete for.
Oh, I see.
You know,
I see
it's
what
very
you
much
mean.
Like
yeah.
High school. I've run into that situation, and it's very uncomfortable.
Right, right.
Because then...
yeah.
Then,
so you're suddenly in this game
of what?
Sport that you're just like I
unaware of.
Yeah, how
what's
I get
the
here?
Game? Yeah,
yeah. And suddenly there's this weird invisible rules being made, and you're like, I'm not following that right now. But still, someone wants to hold you to them. And you're like, I don't really know what these rules are.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just find that needless competition is a waste of time.
That's why it feels so much better for me for cooperation, just growing it, and just seeing like, okay, what are all these ideas? What are all these ideas? And going, now, have you ever had the idea of creating a screenplay or a play that just really, truly, just really allow yourself to have that one time where you put no boundaries on what it should be or how sculpted it ought to be? Have you ever, like, just gone ahead and just did that?
That's how I found all my early plays exactly that way, you know, just... a nugget, just a tiny little image, and just follow it, see where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
ramble on the page for a while. Sometimes you are writing one thing and then you just have a stream of consciousness session and you have another stream of consciousness session and you keep writing this other thing and you realize that something you wrote off the cuff you didn't mean to is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really in the building stage. You know, I mean, when you're really trying to find your story, that's when the least amount of restrictions should be on you, when you're trying to find it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have, you know it's got to be this genre, and you know you want to do this thing, it's very helpful. Because then you can find your story on a road that's mapped. The train isn't mapped.
Right.
But the road is.
You're not going to be able to map it unless you first discover an unseen thing, right?
And the first draft has to be terrible. Everyone's first draft is god-awful. And this sounds like it's something...
And let it be terrible,
yes, it
right?
should be
let
terrible.
It just...
yeah, the vomit draft.
Yeah.
Just vomit on
yeah.
the page.
Right,
and then
right.
you'll sort it out later. But
yeah.
I think as simple as that is, and as many people know about that as they do, a lot of people still get stuck up on that.
Yeah, right.
They'll
yeah,
start
yeah,
writing
yeah.
in their first two paragraphs, oh, this
yeah.
looks terrible, and then they quit. And you can't. You have to realize, okay, this is going to be bad, and I'm going to stick with it. The worst is, well, I've only done one, but I published my first novel. I had it to, you know, three rounds of editing. I worked really hard on it. It sounds really good. So it comes out. I read it again. You know, I know the story. And then I begin writing the second book. Everything sounds awful. Nothing sounds like an English sentence in any way. And I think, God, this is awful. And I have to remind myself, you know, that's finished.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
a polished product, and this is not. So you're going through the process again. So.
Now, do you find that, do you find yourself walking around the house talking as certain characters to try to get more into their minds or, like, inhabiting, you know, this person's mindset? Maybe they like to crochet a lot. And you're like, ooh, what kind of music would they listen to? Or, what would they, you know, or this person likes to ride their unicycle around. You're like, oh, okay, what would they do? You know, where would they go?
I act out all the scenes.
Oh, that's awesome.
I mean, when I'm by myself, I sit down in different chairs. I say the lines with my horrible accents for the characters that probably don't sound anything like them, even though I know exactly how they sound. I have to do that because I have to. That's where the best dialogue comes from.
Yeah, and that's what he does is great. Literally acting out what you're writing is great. You get to play all the roles.
Yeah.
And as far as, you know, going around the house and or taking a walk and listening to the characters, that's so involuntary that the idea, you know, the idea that do you go and do this? It's not really a you go and do. You're so immersed in what you're working on that what you're actually doing is not thinking of anything else. When you're really into it, when I'm really into a piece, it takes over 95% of my higher functioning. With the exception that if there is something very routine in your life that you have to do, like let's say you have a day job, you can still pause the writing and do that job. In my experience, if you've had that routine for a little while, your brain knows, okay, I'm going to sort of save this stuff for later. You'll get ideas here and there, but there's a fear that writers can't have day jobs that aren't writing because it's going to either strangle their voice or they're not going to be focused on their day job. Neither of those are true. They're myths.
Mm, mm-hmm.
There are most writers are smart people who can organize a sentence. And if you're smart enough to write, you're likely smart enough to do a lot of things. Your passion is in writing. So I don't think anyone should feel they have to starve to be a writer until they're successful. And I don't think anyone should think, I can't hire that guy to do this other job or hire this gal to do this other job because she's a writer, because that makes no sense either. That said, if you have the luxury of time, it is a beautiful thing. Because you can then improve as well as finish. You have time to learn from your own successes. And I don't mean the successes of your finished product, but the successes of that day or that minute or that paragraph or the failures.
When you are diving back into your into the story that you're writing, like to help prepare yourself for that, do you end up then finding yourself reading other novels out there by other writers to try to like, okay, let's try to drum up some inspiration here. Maybe this one crime reminds you of a completely different kind of crime that could happen. You're like, ah, or you know, or a solution to something.
Well, I've also just read all of the like famous crimes in books. So I haven't read all the books, but yeah, you try and combine them, or you have some aspect, some element of one that you really like. You know, either playing with the time something happened, or yeah, you can take elements from those and put them into your own. But when I'm diving back in, the main thing I do, yeah, is I think of the crime and all of its mechanics. Where is everybody at every point? What's their motivation? Why are they doing it? And then once I have that and I have the layout of the crime, then it's really just filling in blanks more than anything. It's kind of like a form, a long form. With the first book, the biggest mistake I made was the murder happens in the seventh chapter. And everyone says, you know, first chapter's best, then second, then third, and then you're screwed. Because everyone who reads this, they're looking for one thing. They want that murder.
Mm-hmm.
Give me that murder, baby.
Yeah.
So if they read a book and it happens in the seventh chapter, they're really disappointed. But what I had done, I tried to give my character an arc. And this is one of those rules that you break and you don't know why you're breaking it. And then after, you learn why you broke it and how it was a mistake and how you could do it better. I tried to give him a character arc, which took up time in the opening chapters.
Oh.
And then the murder happened late. Now I realize I will never give any of my detectives a character arc again. If anything, they'll have a protracted character arc over several novels. And they'll finally get somewhere, and little changes will happen to them.
Oh, cool.
But within one book, they barely change at all. And that's one of those rules that I should have known how to break before I broke it.
Are you going to include any monsters or paranormalities in any of your books?
It's never interested me. I like some horror films that have it, but if anything, it would just be the suggestion. Occasionally you read one where they think, ooh, it must have been ghosts because nothing else can explain it. But of course they're going to explain it. If people found out at the end it was ghosts, they would burn your books, probably. And throw them in the fire, yeah.
Which we do not condone.
No.
Clear.
Right, we don't condone it.
Yeah.
All right. We're down to 4 minutes. Anything special you'd like to tell these people before we get out of here? Before we say goodbye to all of you at home viewers?
Well, I like Jamie Lee's idea about the 20 grand.
Yeah, absolutely.
If
send
someone
money.
Wants to send it.
Ah,
yeah.
Please.
20 grand if you got it.
We've been kidnapped. Back to what I said before, there's no one way to make something work. So be careful of following advice where anyone says it has to. Be cognizant of those who have gone down that path before and know where the treacherous pitfalls might lie.
And not to be a total shill, but my book, Goodnight Irene, you can get it on Amazon, author James Scott Burnside. And look out next year, around July, The Opening Night Murders. It's going to be the kind of sequel, and it's going to be even better.
Oh, that's good you said that. And also, where can they find, do you have an Instagram or...
I have a Twitter, Mystery Writer. It's James S. Burnside at Mystery Writer. And also Facebook, Mystery Writer. You can find me there. And I don't post as much as I should. I'm still getting into this. But if you come contact me, if you like my book, if you hate my book, contact me and tell me why. I'd love to hear it.
See that, folks? An open invitation. Read it. Read it while it's hot.
Kurt, this was lots of fun. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
See ya.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.